You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at @PolicyPodcasts.
All right. Well, thank you guys for coming. If the topic of the first panel today was about barriers to new construction, and how to break down those barriers and to increase the supply of housing, then the topic of this panel is existing housing. How well are we using it, and what can we do to increase the value we get from our existing stock of housing? So we're going to talk about fees, transaction costs, vacant and unoccupied residences, and other barriers to finding and buying and moving into an affordable home in a good neighborhood in an area that has good jobs. So today I'm joined by three experts on this panel. You have your bios in your handout, so I will not give lengthy introductions. To my left is Ben Harris. Ben Harris is the former chief economist to the former vice president and current presidential candidate Joe Biden. He now has too many job titles for me to list in their entirety, but I'll say that he's a visiting professor at the Kellogg School of Management and the chief economist for Results for America. To his left is Jack Ryan. Jack Ryan is the co-founder and CEO of Rex. That's a residential real estate company that uses AI and big data to match sellers and buyers of homes at a lower cost. And to his left is Jonas Scheinde, who is the chief economist at the Fiscal Policy Institute, where he heads the institute's research work on budget analysis and economic policy. He is one of the innovators behind the pied à terre tax that was proposed in New York City. That was an idea that captured the attention of New York policymakers earlier this year, and I think it's fair to say terrified the New York real estate brokerage industry. And so I wanted to jump right in with some basic facts. So, and Jack, I wanted to start with you.
Oh, good.
Part of what I wanted to talk about today was transaction costs and how much it costs to buy and sell a house. And so I wanted to start off with just some basic facts. How high are the costs of buying and selling a house in the U.S., and is the U.S. unusual?
Well, thanks first for having me. I'm so sure. Glad to be here with Brookings and with you, Adam, and with Ben and Jonas. It's nice to be with all of you, too. So in the prior panel, we talked about transaction costs and how much it costs to move into a home or buy a home. But one of them are totally unrelated to government proactively, and that is just the huge size of the residential real estate fees. Can you all hear me, by the way? I have a sense of going in and out.
Can you hear it back?
You can all hear me? Okay, great. So ask yourself the following some questions. Why is it that residential real estate brokerage fees are about three times higher in the U.S. than any other developed country in the world? That doesn't strike you as odd? That would be true. The kind of the font of free markets and competition and low SG&A. And why is it that every other consumer-facing agency fee in the U.S., meaning stock brokerage fees, bond brokerage fees, travel agents, taxi dispatchers, they're all down about 80% over the last 10 years, except for one group, residential real estate agents. Isn't that peculiar? And why is it that that the cost of inputs, the labor inputs, to use kind of Ben's background as economist, have gone down for agents over the last 10 or 15 years? No one's asking an agent, really, most people aren't, to drive them around Chevy Chase, Maryland for 8 weekends in a row for 3 hours a weekend to show them a home. That input's gone away. And yet the fees are still the same. Peculiar, isn't it? Why would all those things be happening at the same time? Is there somehow the industry structure that's allowing that to happen? What are the odds that all those are independent events? Probably very low. Must be something systematic going on, right? Should we care? This is why I think this is one of the biggest issues facing public policy people probably in the last 100 years. And you're going to think this is hyperbolic to say this. But there's $1.5 trillion of residential real estate transactions every single year. If you use the international standard of 2 to 3% to sell a home, the rent that's being charged by residential real estate agents in the U.S. is $60 to $70 billion a year. $60 to $70 billion a year is getting moved from consumers' pockets to agents' pockets. huge number. And over the next 10 years, probably $1 trillion, going from middle-class Americans to real estate agents. And then what are the knock-on effects? How many more minutes do I have, by the way?
45. You can talk for as long as you want.
49. Okay. I'll take them all. What are the knock-on effects? I started at Goldman Sachs a long time ago. And to give you a sense for how this affects all the adjacent industries, about a third of the U.S. GDP is consumer services. Most consumer services are attached to buying a home. There's some for manicures and pedicures, but most are attached to buying a home. And so when you think about all the attached services, you get a mortgage, you get home insurance, you get a contractor to fix the house up, you get landscaping, you get a decorator, you buy new furniture. All those things are catalyzed by buying a home. And so when you make the transaction cost really high, guess what happens? The volumes go way down. When I was at Goldman Sachs, it was 12 cents to move a share of stock when I first started. We drove down the price of moving shares from 12 cents to 1 cent using big data and AI. What happened to volumes? The average volume of shares in the New York Stock Exchange went from 100 million shares when I started to about 2 billion a day when I left because the prices went down. What happens when volumes of homes go, trades go up? Guess what? More mortgages, more home insurance, more contractors, more decorators, more furniture, more landscapers. So all these industries are being suppressed because of this group that are taking so much money from consumers for their fees. Well, the last two things I'll say about this is just because it's a cultural issue and a tax issue. When you suppress transactions, guess what happens? Capital gains tax goes down because the federal government taxes on capital gains tax. State revenues go down because property tax is attached to the value of the home, right? So when you trade homes, the value of homes go up. And then state and local taxes go down because there's a transfer tax in most jurisdictions to fund police and teachers and firemen when you trade homes. And the last thing is, when it costs a lot to sell a home, job mobility goes down, and then home ownership goes down because it costs so much to buy a home. So this group of people are damaging the economy in ways that I think is trillions of dollars over the next 10 years, trillions, and probably maybe a quarter of GDP every year, 0.25%. Anyway, so I think it can be fixed. We're trying to fix it. We can talk more about that, but I know I'm running out of time.
Well, I want to ask a couple of follow-up questions. So I agree that in most other markets, these transaction costs have gone way down. I buy my plane tickets online now, and my stock trades are, as you say, extremely cheap through an online brokerage. But now there are places there are websites like Zillow and Redfin, and why haven't those made a dent in these costs?
Well, so as you know, Zillow is lead generation for agents. You go there to look for a home, and they send you to a traditional agent. And then everybody else, and this is the peculiar thing about the industry, there's the residential real estate agents who join the MLS, and there's one company that's not doing it through the MLS, and that's us. But why is everybody else doing it the exact same way? And one is the access to data. The MLS gets the data when you sell a home, they keep it, they hold it to themselves. Imagine if you could not know what the last share traded was for IBM, the last price and the last volume. You can only get it if you join the Goldman Sachs Trading Association. What would happen to the price of trading shares? It would have never gone down if you had asked Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley for approval to get the information. Right? So one is the suppression of data. Now, we hire data scientists from Harvard and Stanford and MIT to help us predict things, and we go around that. But if you're a normal realtor, you can't get access to the data. The other thing I'll just share with you, a few other things about why this has happened. If you join the MLS, there's a rule that if you list a home with an MLS agent, you must also offer to pay a buy-side agent commission at the same moment. Sure. They tie those two together by fiat. To me, it's a legal tying arrangement. You buy one service, you must buy another. And you're supposed to pick the price that you will offer the buy-side agent at the moment you list the home that is never modifiable. So you have to name a price for a buy-side agent for a buyer you don't know and guess how much they might want to pay at the moment you sign a listing agreement months before you even met a buyer. Right? There's so many things that they're doing to constrain competition that results in these fees that are so high relative to almost any other developed country. I can go more. There's about 20 things that happen.
Sure,
that's why we're not a member of it. But I don't want to take all the time on the panel. I'd like Ben and Jones to have a chance to speak. But I can go through all the things that they do to create the
monopoly.
What'd you say? Monopoly.
I'm sorry.
saying barriers to competition. So I can see that position. Well, Ben, to follow up on that, first of all, do you think that there is a competition problem in this market? And what do you think the broader consequences are of the high transaction costs that are associated with buying and selling homes?
So transactions costs, depending on how you measure them, are about 9% of the volume of the price of a house. Just some of the basic facts. And so around 5.5% of that is around the realtor fee, but we also have origination fees for mortgage. We have transaction taxes in local jurisdictions, which vary a lot. In Pittsburgh, they just raise it from 4% to 4.5%, but a lot of cities and states don't have any. There is title insurance. So, you know, all combined, one, there's a lot of heterogeneity in transaction costs, but it's around 9% nationally on average. And so the question is this a problem? Of course it is. I mean, the house is the biggest purchase that most households will ever make. And if you're talking about 9-10% of that, of course that's a massive cost. So let's put it in sort of a broader macroeconomic context and move way, 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 30,000 foot level. For about 100 years in the United States, from about 1880 to 1980, there was a convergence in incomes by cities, right? So the poor cities were catching up to the richer cities at about 1.8% a year. That's a good thing, right? We want to sort of all see these cities converge together. Something happened around 1980 where this slowed down to about half that rate. They were still converging, but they were converging much more slowly. And then around the Great Recession, this stopped. And cities just are not converging anymore. So why aren't cities converging anymore? One reason why cities aren't converging anymore is because people aren't moving anymore. And so, you know, if you look at mobility patterns going back to 1950, within county moving, so the rate at which people move within their county has fallen from about 13% down to around 6%. That's a big change. People move a lot less within the county. Intra-county moving, so moving from one county to another county, has declined from around 6% to 4%. This is a really big problem because before it was happening is people were moving from areas where there wasn't opportunity to places where there was opportunity. If they're not going to move, the problems of income inequality and income growth become much more challenging. So why aren't incomes converging? Because people aren't moving. Why aren't people moving? Because it's really costly to do so. And so there's this really good paper that showed that people just are not moving to higher income areas. So by the way, it used to happen, it used to be for this 100-year period, it used to be that people would move from poor areas to richer areas. It also is true that capital would flow to poor areas. If you wanted to build a factory, you're not going to build it in the heart of San Francisco. You're going to go to, you know, Allentown or Gary, Indiana, or somewhere it's cheaper to build a factory. And that would end up lifting up that place and sort of lead to this convergence of income. So that's not really happening anymore. And, you know, one of the things that's going on right now is it's just too expensive to move to the high opportunity areas. You can look at janitors, for example. There's this paper. Let me just cite a few statistics that can really hammer this home. People get paid more to be a janitor in San Francisco than they do in the Deep South. You get paid more as a janitor to be in New York City than you do in rural Mississippi, even though you're doing the same work. That's just a fact. But the problem is that the housing costs in New York eat up all of your wage premia and then some. So you're asking, why are people moving from the Deep South where there isn't a great opportunity in New York City? Because it's too expensive to live there, which makes sense, but here's some numbers. So this paper showed, okay, so in nominal terms, the wages of, but so here's the other point, which is that for people who are lawyers, it makes sense to move from the Deep South to New York because your wage premium more than accounts for that bump up in housing price. But if you're a middle-income worker, or particularly if you're a low-income worker, it doesn't make sense. It's just too expensive. So in nominal terms, the wages of lawyers and janitors are 45% and 32% higher in New York, respectively, in 2010. But housing costs are more in New York and the Deep South for janitors, 21% for lawyers and 52% for janitors in New York. So after adjusting for housing prices, the premia are 37% for the lawyer who moves from the Deep South to New York and -6% for the janitor. So the basic point is that if a lawyer moves from the Deep South to New York, they get a 37% bump in after-housing wages. The janitor gets a 6% wage cost. It doesn't make any sense for the janitor to move from the Deep South to New York because housing is so damn expensive. And so part of it are the transactions costs we've been talking about, and part of it were just the sort of general housing costs we were talking about earlier. But the story that we're trying to tell, and I'll wrap this up, the story we're trying to tell where the United States is supposed to be this land of opportunity where people can move from poor areas to rich areas, The big barrier right there are that housing costs are just too high for them to do that. And that's, you know, that's one of the biggest barriers we're facing. I agree with you. It's one of the biggest economic challenges of our time.
Thank you. So I wanted to explore next a slightly different barrier to affordability in these cities. And I wanted to ask Jonas a question about his the debate around his pied a terre tax. So several cities around the world, like Vancouver, Singapore, Paris, all tax vacant properties or second homes at higher rates. D.C. has a tax on vacant property, for instance. You proposed a widely discussed pied a terre tax in New York that would have applied to high-end homes that were second residences or vacant. Before talking about the details of that proposal and the fiscal consequences, because part of it was a revenue proposal and a finance, part of it was also an effort to, especially in other places, to affect the housing market, to make sure that all the land is being used. And so I just wanted to start off with a question of how much vacant or underutilized land is there in some of these big cities? And in other cities, what has been the effect of trying to encourage more of that those properties to be used for local residents?
This is a good question. Well, you see, the rise of the cities that we have now is not a new development. It's been going on for a while. And the problems have been international and they've been observed in other places. And in the United States, I think the progression is quite interesting because for a large portion of American history, it's been a very agricultural country with a lot of land, a lot of resources, and a lot of people think about the United States as a country with a lot of space, you know, a lot of living space. And then we became more industrial, and of course that made some cities more important, you know, strategic, a location near the iron ore mines and so on and so forth, distributional centers like Chicago and all that. And as the economy is becoming more service-based, we don't need as many people first. And we get a lot more concentration. So a lot of other places have been dealing with these kinds of problems. And what happens usually when the cities rise and they become very prominent destinations for business and commerce and finance and construction and services and lawyers, et cetera, the ecosystem, the economic ecosystem of those places becomes a very good insurer of property values. So you may not want to live there, but if you want to park your money, those are the places to go. So what other places? Well, Mumbai is probably a very, very good place. Paris is a good place. Everybody wants to be in Paris. New York, the home of the party, the rent is too damn high party, is a place like that. Everybody wants to be in New York, I think, supposedly. And so that creates the disparity in how many people own multiple units and have their living situation all fixed, and how many people are struggling. And of course, in smaller places like Vancouver, that is the first such policy innovator and pied a terre tax, that they have there is a very interesting one to look at. It's much easier to notice that something is going incorrectly. Right? So Vancouver residents, the politicians decided to charge a 1% empty home tax and the tax on foreign buyers. So there is this, and a lot of places are like this. Singapore is like this, and it's a small place, so they try to make sure that the local residents are able to live somewhere, and they have a very strong public housing program there as well. So what other places are doing normally, they have the second home tax, and they have a foreign buyer tax or a form of a foreign buyer tax. So in the city of New York, we cannot charge a special tax, it's going to be unconstitutional for for foreign buyers, but the second homes, we could do that. Now, of course, our proposal doesn't go as far as to prohibit multiple homes being bought and owned. It's not intended to move the market in a significant way, but it was part of the discussion of the infrastructure debate. The subway system that we have is crumbling, so it was just part of the discussion to raise some revenue and help a little bit to do that. But I think the discussion could be broadened, and we can have a really strong conversation about whether or not the markets are designed properly to deliver the types of outcomes that we would want.
Well, so in New York, New York is obviously a big market, but in Vancouver, my sense was that when they imposed that tax, it had real effects on the market.
It is very difficult to say what really impacted the market. Is it the foreign buyer tax or is it the pied-à-terre tax? But there are some articles about what is going on there with their real estate. So the benchmark prices went down by 8%, 8 and change percent. Is that because of the problems with the Chinese demand, or is it because of something else? We do not know. There are some articles, also some reporting, that now all those pied-à-terres become very affordable rentals, right? So, and even students can afford them. So that, I think, is a positive development.
Sure. A question on the earlier panel, I thought, was are the Russian oligarchs responsible for the rising New York prices? It sounds like in that market the answer is no, but in a small market like Vancouver, it seemed like the influence of foreign buyers was much larger, and especially when they were keeping those.
I would not be dismissive of that comment. I think it has a great validity, but but the way markets are usually, if there is a very strong demand at the top of the market. And not everybody is going to be able to sell those kinds of units, but they are going to be produced, right? So it attracts the productive resources from other segments that could be delivering more affordable options, more economic options to lower income people and middle income people. So there is a role that the foreign buyers play in New York, the oligarchs and absolutely shady characters that could buy real estate with questionable funds and not disclose where the money is coming from.
Who goes the Delaware LLC or something like that? In some sense, when you motivated your in the paper that motivated this tax, the tax treats vacant property almost as like a negative externality, something that's like a black hole in the neighborhood, and that should be in some ways taxed away. I can see it multiple ways. So on one hand, these non-resident buyers are paying property tax, and they're not necessarily using local schools, and they're not necessarily wearing and tearing the local streets. Yeah. But what's the other side of that? What would you hope to achieve if more local residents lived in those places?
Well, a tax is a tax, right? So it doesn't solve all the problems, and it shouldn't solve all the problems, but. But as I said earlier, the entire economic environment around those properties is conducive to the property values increasing and being shored up. Well, what we'll lose if we have a lot of empty condos and houses, we'll lose the 24-hour community. So we don't have as much, or we have less of the civil and the civic engagement there. And if you walk down the street in many areas in Manhattan, there's nobody there after a certain hour. Right? So of course it's a busy place. There are a lot of businesses, but all those businesses they need to be sustained and not just especially the local businesses, the restaurants, the mom-and-pop shops, as they hold. They need to be sustained by more hours of people going into them and buying stuff than they are currently. So we have this, I think, it's a rolling story in New York that the long-time restaurants and small businesses, they just shut down because they cannot, they don't see that demand there. So their services are not needed. And all we have in many such places, in many neighborhoods around New York, all we have is national chains and banks and pharmacies, which are, of course, very good businesses. But the character of the neighborhoods are changed negatively.
I mean, you've got an economic argument for this, and you've got a political argument for this. The economic argument is that if you were going to design your ideal community, it would never be absentee landlords who lived, 6,000 miles away and just happen to show up once a year. I mean, that's not the idea of community that most of us want. And so what do we do in economics if there's something which is bad or harmful? We tax it. We tax cigarettes. We tax soda in some places. And so why not tax people who only show up once a year? The political side of this is that, and so in 2016, we went to, when I was Vice President Biden's chief economist, we went on a sort of a state trip to Australia and New Zealand. And Australia is remarkable because we were in Sydney, and the Sydney real estate prices have just shot up over the past several years. I don't know why, but everyone in Sydney thinks it's because of the Chinese. So you would get into a taxi, and the taxi driver would say, "Can you believe what's happened to our real estate prices? It's all the rich Chinese." You would go, you get your haircut. They're talking about how the Chinese are driving up their real estate prices. You go to a state dinner, and they're talking about how the Chinese are driving their real estate prices. It's a really politically convenient thing to do, to tax the rich Chinese investor. No one likes taxes, but if I'm a politician, and I'm not, and I'm a politician in Sydney, it's a lot easier to levy this pied-à-terre tax than it is to boost property taxes on native Australians. That feels like a much harder thing to do.
In New York, you struggled with this tax, right? At the end of the day, it felt like it was beaten back by the real estate industry. At the end of the day, it was enacted as a 1% transaction cost instead. Like, what do you think the barriers are to getting these things done?
Well, I think we need a wider discussion about this. There's just I was very surprised with the level of attention that this proposal got. It's been around for a while, but this year we needed to find some money in New York to fund the MTA, and so this was the part of that discussion. Yes, of course. The sales tax, right? So which we got, which is a one-time tax that the buyers of properties over $1 million worth are going to be paying. Of course, it's not nothing. I think it's a good start, and maybe we could revisit this question at some next time.
I think your timing was helped by someone buying a $238 million condo, right?
Right.
Yeah. So that enhanced your attention.
Well, that property actually, the market price, of course, is $238, but the taxable value is only several million dollars. So there's a huge difference between the amounts that are paid in transactions and what the city and the state get.
And those are development incentives. Is that what the reason is?
Well, it's a combination of a lot of things. So there are some abatements, of course, that the buyers get if it's a new property, if it's a newly constructed property. So there's that. But also, New York has a very complicated a property tax system that doesn't evaluate a lot of properties, condos and co-ops as houses. So we evaluate them as comparable rentals in the area. So I do not know what the 238 several-story apartment is comparable to and how much it would rent. in a four, but that's the system we use, and it's and it needs to be, again, looked at and maybe reevaluated whether or not it's a good system to have.
I mean,
probably not.
Yeah, probably not. Probably not. The traditional way we think about the influence of taxes on home ownership and affordability is through provisions like Prop 13 in California, where we have reductions in property tax rates. Or at the federal level, we provide deductions for mortgage interest and a deduction for state and local taxes. The Tax Cuts and Job Act just capped those at $10,000. So in many high-cost, it capped the deductibility of state and local income taxes. It also placed limitations on how much mortgage interest you could deduct. And so I think in a lot of the coastal cities in particular, there's a concern that this is impairing affordability. And so I wanted to get your take about what you think that that bill did to home prices, if anything, and what that actually means for home ownership.
So the bill did three things. It, as you mentioned, it reduced the maximum price of a mortgage on which you could deduct interest from $1 million to $750,000, although mortgages were grandfathered in. It capped the amount of deductible state and local taxes, including income taxes, you could deduct at $10,000. But the big thing it did is it doubled the standard deduction, roughly doubled the standard deduction. It just killed itemization. Right? Over, and people are still sort of, I think, realizing this as you're getting their tax returns back and filing their taxes, but the rate of itemization fell from middle class families. The rate of taking the mortgage interest deduction for middle class families fell from around 20% down to around 7%. And for those who were in the fourth quintile, it fell even more. And if you look at those taking the state and local tax deduction, you saw reductions from around 50% for sort of middle income families down to around in the high teens, I think. So TCJA just killed itemization. Now the question is, did it impact housing affordability? And it depends on who you ask. It depends on, do you own a house or are you wanting to buy a house? If you own a house, it's this sort of this negative windfall, right? So now the house which you bought under the prior tax law and expected to be able to afford under the prior tax law now just became more expensive. But that's all capitalized into the price of the house. So if you're looking to buy a house, you don't own one, it might be a bit cheaper. And so you have this sort of complicated price effect between people who own houses and who don't. You also have this complicated price effect between expensive areas and not very expensive areas. So if you're comparing, for example, a coastal city where you have a really high price-to-rent ratio, where you have really high, like New York, New Jersey, a lot of people are taking the state and local deduction. There were itemizers before. You know, that price impact is much stronger than it would be in somewhere in the heartland or somewhere else where incomes tend to be lower. And we're already seeing some evidence of this. So the New York Fed went ahead and did some analysis on this, and they're finding price-to-rent ratios are converging really sharply in the wake of TCJA. So I think that there's already some anecdotal evidence, not necessarily academic evidence, but pretty solid evidence by the New York Fed that that prices are coming down or being capitalized into coastal cities, which to me feels fairly unfair to people who purchase a home under a certain set of laws, but might be, you know, good news for someone who's hoping to get into a house.
So in New York, when the pied-à-terre tax failed, they went with the transactions tax. And so I want to turn to this topic of transaction taxes or transaction fees for a second. Those seem to be like widely used sorts of taxes. And also the fees that we pay to realtors seem so high, and yet I'm wondering why this is. And I speculate that it's because people buy and sell homes so rarely that that they just don't notice these fees, or that they, when you own homes, I mean, I've never sold a home, so I've never actually paid a broker's fee ostensibly myself, and I've only paid this transaction tax in D.C. one time. Why does this sand in the gear of the market persist?
Well, I'll take a crack at that. You know, one is the point you're making. People buy or sell home once on every 7 to 10 years on average. And it's pretty complicated, and so they don't spend a lot of time thinking about it for 7 or 8 years. All of a sudden, all ones you have to think about buying a home, a broker's fee, a mortgage rate, insurance, title, escrow, and it's almost like it's too much to handle, and you need to move into a house by a certain time, so you just kind of pay the man, to use the phrase, right? You just get it over with. And all those people along the way you're dealing with are unsalaried, totally commissioned people. You're the mark. They know that you need to buy a home within 2 months. They know that you don't do this every once every 7 years. They know everything, and they're totally commission-driven. So it's a very bad asymmetric knowledge battle going on there. Yeah. And the other thing that I'm surprised the FTC lets people get away with is what economists call lying prices. They lay people say that, hey, list your home for 2%, even though the total no one cares to list a home. They want to sell their home. Right? What good is it to list your home? It doesn't do anything for you. And to sell your home is actually, you know, 5 or 6% because you got paid this forced broker's fee of 3%. But they don't allow car dealers to say, you know, come on, get into a minivan on my lot for $20,000. You can't drive it off for less than $40,000, but come in and sit in the lot. The engine and the steering wheel are separate. Right? The FTC stopped that a long time ago. They said no more listing the half price for the car, all in, drive off a lot, you have to put it on the ad. Right, same with consumer electronics. No longer say TV is available for $100. Come get it. You get there and there's no TV for $100, and they want to sell you a $500 one. But you see all the time, list your home for 2%, not telling you the other half of the transaction is when you want to sell it, there's a 3% fee or bigger to the buyer, right? Buyer side agent, right? And the other thing I'd just like to highlight one more time is because of this kind of economist version of what's called lying prices, is I think that's one of the reasons why there's the residential MLS industry, all of them, kind of the big blob. And then there's us by ourselves. Why are their fees all the same, process all the same, speed all the same, transparency all the lack of the same, and there's one company doing it totally differently? By the way, it's called Rex. We're moving to Washington, D.C. this week. Just want you to know. But why would that be true? So anyway, I think a lot of it has to do with transparency of information because consumers only get themselves involved in this every 7 years, and they don't know a lot, and all the information is being husbanded by those who does every day for a living, who are totally commission-driven people. Not that they're bad people, but the incentives are totally different. The focus, the attention, the knowledge asymmetry is dramatic for the people buying and selling a home.
Well, I mean, in a lot of those markets where the buyers don't have a lot of information and are in some ways victims of those with better information, we have a government regulator or a policy that we implement. And why is there not something like that? Or I guess, first of all, is there a role for that here? And like, what role would that be? And what are the barriers to that?
Well, from my point of view, from a governmental point of view, just like the SEC does with stocks and bonds, is you got to disclose the price at which something sold within some quick period of time. If you could keep that all information to yourself and not share with anybody else who's in the public, the fees would never drop for any of the stocks, bonds, travel agents, anything. So, you know, just put the information out there. And once the information gets out there, consumers have proven out to be really smart. Once they have the information, the data about stocks, bonds, taxi dispatchers, travel agents, they'll make the right determination. They know the other homes have traded in the market. They know the price they sold at. And the prices will, the transaction costs will come down really quickly. Now, I know this is more about just the real estate transaction cost, but just think about this as like a 4 or 5% tax per transaction relative to the international marketplace. And then there's the state taxes and the property tax and the pied à terre tax. But all these, you know, add up. But the pied à terre tax, which is getting a lot of attention, is 1%, right? Is that what it is? 1%. The amount that's being paid to U.S. brokers versus the international standard is probably 3 to 4%. It should have four times the attention that you've gotten, but it hasn't yet.
I mean, so those are two really different questions that you posed at the beginning. Let me just sort of piggyback on what Jack was saying. One is, so why do we have transactions taxes when you buy and sell a home? I mean, you know, we tax a lot of things we think are good. We tax wages, we tax investment. Those are all good things. But the money has to come from somewhere. And maybe states and localities are doing it because they want to diversify. And as I said at the beginning, there are a lot of cities that don't have these transactions taxes. But also it's a salience issue. So we know from other studies, for example, when we used to have to sort of reach into our glove box when we went through a toll when you're driving and take out the 6 quarters and throw it in, then we shifted to these little white boxes that you put on the front of your car. You don't really think about it. You just drive through. You knew that people sort of the perception around those taxes changed. It was easier to pay it. You didn't think about it each time. You got an automatic payment on your credit card. And from Amy Finkelstein and others, we know that that people became less sensitive to the taxation, we became less salient. And as Jack said, with transaction taxes, maybe you're going to pay it once every 7 or 8 years. You're going to get it along with a million other fees on your was formerly the HUD one, and you just don't think about it. The question is, so why do we have these persistently high realtor fees? And there is some decent evidence that there's lack of competition in the real estate market. So there's a couple of reasons why. So one, so Pamela Jarwick, who's this economist at Cornell, looked at the impact of people or realtors when they drop their fees, right? So all else equal, if you can sell a home for 5.7% instead of 6%, you should go with that. But the problem is one of steering. So when you had discount buyer's fees, you saw discount buyer's fees, right? They're being steered away from those homes. And the volume went down, the likelihood of selling the home went down, and the amount of time that you would sell the house went up. So there's this sort of natural disincentive towards offering a lower cost, which is that the realtor would be steered away from the home. And they looked at 650,000 transactions. This was nationwide. And they found pretty systematic steering going on. And what's happening, too, another sort of indication there might be anti-competition in the realtor market is that there's bunching around certain prices. So it's very common to have the buyer's fee be 2.5%. It's very uncommon for it to be 2.4%. Right? And so when you start to see bunching around prices, that's sort of suggestive of anti-competition. And that could be what's going on here. A third thing which is happening is at the state level, there's some state laws which definitely inhibit competition. So in many states, you cannot get a kickback from your realtor, right? So if your realtor says, if you're a buyer and you say, look, you're going to get 3%, how about you give me 1%? That's illegal in some states, which is crazy. Why is that illegal? In other states, you can't have a la carte pricing. So in some states, you can't say, look, I don't want the full package when I buy and sell home. I only want part of it. That's illegal in some states. There's no economic justification for that. So your initial question was a great one, but it really depends on if we're talking about transactions taxes or if we're talking about realtor fees. The forces driving those up are incredibly different.
Fair.
You know what's just fascinating about this, though, and this is what we learned when I was trading for Goldman, and now we do it for homes, is on the steering issue, is if you're marketing to an agent, the agent's allowed to steer because they control the information. When you took out the New York Stock Exchange floor broker and did high-frequency trading or sale, you went to the consumer directly and said, do you want to buy a million shares of IBM at 72 and a quarter, yes or no, and what price would you want to buy it, and the computer stores it. If you go directly to the consumer, go around the agent, directly to the seller, which we do with big data and AI, you can find the buyers and say, this home is available, would you like to buy it or not? Whatever answer they give you, no answer, yes, I do, no, I don't, the computer gets smarter and smarter. This is called reinforced learning. And realizes who are the better buyers of this home based on the feedback they got from the first deployment of the information. I think as we move to the big data AI world of marketing homes, the steering problem is going to go away because even if an agent were to get in the middle somehow and tell a buyer, do you really want to buy that home? I think there's a nuclear waste dump next door because they're not going to get the fee they want. They don't know we dropped a cookie on the person who came to see the home. And an ad's flying around saying open house, you know, next week, or there's a map of the property next door. So they can't see there's no nuclear waste dump next door. If the agent said the home's not for sale, why is there a ad following me around saying the open house tomorrow? So the big data AI, which we're a big data AI company, we can predict the seller, predict the buyer, and then the last mile of the transaction humans still have to do. But I think technology solves some of the steering problem, but some of it still is this agency problem where the buyer's agent's being paid by the seller. You don't have steering going on if the buyer's agent's paid by the buyer. You only have a steering problem if the buyer's agent is paid by the seller. By the way, in what sense is someone a buyer's agent when they're paid by the seller? Right? You never allow in a court of law that the defendant's attorney is paid by the plaintiff's attorney. Right? That would never work. Yeah. But this is the forced linkage when you say if you sell a home, seller, you must pay a fee to a buyer's agent allows the steering to occur. And so once you break that, the steering would go away. But in the meantime, I think, you know, we're a big data AI company. We can predict the buyer and then avoid the steering. We're not using the agent to find the buyer.
And that's what panel says. It's the bundling is the fundamental problem.
Yeah, the
problem.
Bundling is the problem.
It's the fundamental problem. That's her point of view. And there is regulatory attention being paid to this. So the FTC just had a public meeting. They invited comments on this issue. It was an issue, you know, 10 years ago. They're revisiting it. So there is some federal regulatory attention being paid to this issue.
And do you think they're going to make progress? I mean, you think is it the FTC's job or is it DOJ's job? Like, if this really is, as he says, a monopoly that's being, perpetuated illegally or through some sort of collusion, like, what do these regulators do?
So I would never want to get in the middle of the FTC-DOJ jurisdiction discussion, so I'm going to punt on that one.
Okay. But you think that there's an opportunity?
I think the advertising issue, can you say I'll list your home for 2% or something when you really know the cost is 5 or 6%? That seems to be an FTC issue. I could be wrong about, false advertising. On the who is responsible for breaking the forced tying arrangement, when you list a home, you must also pay for some buyer's agent, whether a buyer needs them or not. You have to set the price for that buyer's agent at the moment you list your home, not knowing if the buyer needs an agent or not. You're always told, it must be 3%. You don't want to scare anybody away, right? I think that probably is, I don't know, it might be an FTC, DOJ issue, but certainly falls into, me, in my view, a Sherman Act problem when you have forced tying of services.
I'd like to ask the audience if they have any questions for this group. You, sir. Is there a mic? There's not a mic. Well, can you just stand up and we'll be quiet.
I work on the issues of wealth concentration a lot. So on the issue of taxing an empty unit, it's an idea for Trump, including you have a group of people with this tax that are going to be hurt.
Oh, you have this is for Trump and Putin. I don't know about Biden. So you got these, the tax will disadvantage a group of people, so they oppose it, but there's no winners. So what if you make the tax higher and you waive the tax if the oligarch, who's say he's just buying it for insurance, right, in case he has to leave the country. He doesn't need to live there. If he leases it to a young family that lives in New York and only charges them 30% of their income, and then you put, no pets. But I mean, like, there's got to be some people. Maybe the oligarchs can help us fill in these empty spots, and they can get. I would make the tax higher and give them an option. And also on the, why are these? I give money to my local state representative. He's a lawyer for the real estate industry, and he's in the state legislature. And my guess is there's a million little fees and things that they have ensconced in state law that support this whole 5% array of services that you have to have. So I wonder if you run into that. So two different questions. Sorry.
Well, I probably would place no trust or hope with the Russian oligarchs at this point. But of course, it's a question of how to best engineer the tax, how to apply it best. I mean, there are some other, ways of doing it. Let's say, increase the property taxes for everybody, and then provide the abatements on tax discounts on the properties that are the primary residences of the people. So it's possible to do that, this way, or it's possible to, to tie, say, the revenues from this to public housing and other stuff like that. So it's possible to do that, and of course that is the discussion that needs to be had. Now, I think Jack knows a lot more about the fees, but every New Yorker is a little bit of a real estate agent, so. real estate is not stocks, right? Because they're not uniform. So there's a lot of physicality there, a lot of variables. How do you compare an apartment that has 700 square feet and has a balcony and the one that doesn't have a balcony? Or the one that has a southern exposure and the northern exposure? So these are all variables that are, the array of these variables is, it's so large that, of course, the real estate agents are the ones that, that hoard that knowledge, and knowledge is power, and power, of course, is translated into more profits. But I think...
Well, this probably is Ben's territory, but, every asset's substitutable in the real estate space. They're not identical, they're not commodities, but they're substitutable. And humans all the time are making judgments about the southern exposure versus the northern exposure. It turns out that the computers, we run billions of algorithms, per day, take all this into consideration and can give you a good sense for what a home is worth, as long as the information is available. I just need the information. This was not true 7 years ago, 5 years ago, because the cloud, the cost of storing data has gone from $5 a gig to half a penny a gig. Mm-hmm. So we have an infinite attic that stores as much information as we want to. Can run algorithms against the information in real time, deploy against the algorithm in 100 milliseconds, get the response back, and redeploy a new algorithm. Anyway, so the point of this is that you can have a million variables, and we can still make a prediction and change a computer in real time against prediction about who's the right buyer for this home, what this home is worth. Having said that, you're referring to the state legislator. The state legislator, it's very interesting. For instance, Ben was saying that some states say you can't get rebates. New Jersey is an example. We give, you know, there's this huge fee that goes to buyers, agents. For many people, it's worth it. Many people, it's not. Everyone's looking at the home on their own, and truly, and they have an agent open the door, and the agent got 3% of $800,000, $24,000 to open the door. Can't we give a lot of that money back to the consumer, to the buyer? We try to rebate half or more back to the consumer. New Jersey says that's illegal. We can't give money back to consumer? That sounds odd. Why can't we do that? What's the public policy for that? So this is the point you're making, Ben, about in certain states, I think you're talking about regulatory capture. The regulator managing the industry is actually part of the industry, maybe, is what you're referring to. Why would that be true? You know, so why is it that some state legislators say you can't rebate the fees to a consumer?
Yeah. I don't know why. I just know it's anti-competitive.
Okay.
I think New Jersey was also the state that where you couldn't buy a Tesla because you had to buy all your cars through a dealership. So they like their middlemen a lot there. There was another question. Yes, right there.
Hello, my name is Maria Contas. I'm 29 years a realtor.
Yay.
So I want to defend myself. For 25 years, I had my own firm in Athens, Greece. I know the European real estate market very, very well. And now I'm working with Sotheby's here in D.C.
Yay.
So I would like to say that the reason we have realtors is the same reason that you have lawyers, meaning that you cannot imagine. I have seen the smartest people in the luxury market that I work for say the dumbest things when they are emotionally involved and they want a specific home. And the same stands for the sellers. So the reason that agents are here and we are charging a fee, which actually we charge the fee, we might show 100 homes to 1,000 people, and we are getting paid only for the deals that we close, is that because we can eliminate the emotional factor out of the buyers and the sellers. And what I want to say is that the fees here in the US are not as high as they are in Europe. In Europe, they are divided between the seller and the buyer. They can be even higher. And I would like to say something to you because my brother is the acting CFO of the IRS right now, and also a professor in GW for public economics, is that U.S. right now is a very safe and regulated real estate market. All these wealthy people, which is my market that I work right now, from Europe, from Russia and all these countries, they are going to come here, and they are coming here. So what you're going to do with taxation is a different thing. Find ways to tax them, because of course they haven't paid taxes all these years in order to come here and buy real estate, but it's a fact. And the more unstable the European market is, all these clients are coming. Thank you very much.
So I'm really glad you made that statement, which wasn't a question, but it's important because you raised the question of... I'm glad you said this. So from my perspective, realtors provide a service and should be compensated for that service. I've bought and sold 4 homes, which is far too many, and I had a realtor each time. She's Ivy League educated. She went to Brown. She's incredibly smart, and she's saved me some...
But she went to Brown.
She went from some really bad decisions. The problem is not that realtors are compensated for providing the service. They should be. Absolutely. That's without question. The problem is that we have a market that discourages being able to offer differential prices for that service. So the problem is we have a market which basically makes it very difficult to be set at other than 2.5% or 2% for the purchase of a home. And if we had a market that said plumbers are all paid $20 or $200 for a certain service, and we didn't allow the market to work the way it was supposed to and have differential prices for the plumber, if I couldn't compete on services for my plumber, that's the real problem. It's not that we have plumbers in the first place, because of course we need plumbers. The problem is we can't compete over those prices for services, and there are certain institutional barriers in the realty market which make me concerned that we can't compete over those prices.
And sometimes I'm getting paid the same percentage as some bad agent is getting paid. The thing is, and I have an answer for that, coming now and relocated to the U.S. market for the last 3 years from Europe, is that United States market is a very fair market. It's an open market, meaning that at the end, the bad agent is going to be at the side. He's not going to have work, and I think that if you work hard in the United States, you are getting compensated and you're getting what you deserve. So I think that's the answer. And I thought about that many, many times, as I told you, because I relocated recently. Why me or somebody else? And you have thousands of agents here, especially in the DC market. In Europe, there are much less agents. But this is the answer. I mean, the good is always going to survive. The bad, the market is going to throw him out.
Well, so I just want to say two things. One, thank you for saying what you said so politely and so nicely. I really appreciate your thoughts.
You're my worst nightmare.
Such a generous voice. You are awesome. But you are fantastic. It was fantastic. So there's good agents, and some may be worth 5 or 6%. I just echo Ben's point that it's hard to know. For instance, you're selling a home in the Bay Area. Should it cost you 5 or 6% when the home gets sold in 3 days for $3 million to sell that home? Why can't you sell it for us, pay the seller agent 0.5% and nothing to the buy side agent? Because the day after you list it, 50 people are lined up to buy the home. But no, that fee is still 5 or 6%. So it's not that that shouldn't be the right fee for you, because I'm sure you're very good at it, for the right homes that you sell. But why is that true everywhere, to Ben's point? It doesn't seem to make any sense. I think there'll be people like in the stock market, there'll be people who charge you a lot and do a really good job.
Exactly.
And there'll be E-Trade that does very little for you, but you're very smart and great, use E-Trade. There should be a variety of services, price at which you can choose to use a service, and there isn't right now, other than us, to do that. So that's my point.
There was a question.
Thank you.
Right there.
Hi, my name is Rosalie again. We were talking about buying and selling houses, but I was wondering the renter's point of view. And then U.S. housing policy was traditionally favored the homeowners. And I was wondering what would be the long-term consequence of lack of federal level attention for the renter. And each of you, I want to hear about your personal thoughts in terms of the future of middle class initiative. How does that affect to the economic mobility? Because, for example, if you are paying one third of your income into your housing cost, and you have to eat, you have to transport, the transportation costs, and there's not enough money to save or for the future. So.
So I think this is a terrific question. It's a tough one. If you lined up 100 economists, this is just a guess, this is zero empirical evidence, and said, should we subsidize home ownership? My guess is maybe 20 out of those 100 would say yes. I happen to think there's value in home ownership, social value in home ownership. People are more actively engaged. They're better citizens when they're homeowners. I think home ownership is worth subsidizing. But then you get the very valid point which you brought up, which is, look, for some people, housing costs, this was earlier in this program, housing costs can approach 50% of your income. That leaves very little left over for things like college, food, I mean, all the other fees. And shouldn't we be subsidizing those people as well? And that's a perfectly valid point. But then if you're both subsidizing renting and you're subsidizing home ownership, what are you trying to achieve? Right? I mean, so why don't you just... Yeah, so I mean, this is a really tough. You're the only person that was funny. But so
that was really
I mean,
funny.
So you know, when it comes to one of the things you can do it with the cost of renting is on the wage side, which is try to look for subsidies to or ways not subsidies, but for strategies for boosting wages, so that even though the rents might not come down, people have more income, so they have more money left over for other things. Now, this is I'm not talking about sort of subsidizing low income and making affordable housing. That's obviously has merit. I'm talking about sort of general credits for rent. And I guess my only point here is I think it's tough to subsidize both rent for everyone and homeownership for everyone because you end up back at the same spot.
Hi, Elon Sykes. We had a question in an earlier panel about property or land taxes, and I guess when we're talking about sort of transaction costs and incentives to develop and fill empty apartments, whether it would be feasible or worthwhile to explore some of the more creative proposals for taxation of land and property, like old school with Henry George's proposal to tax the value of land without the improvements, or sort of the wackier Eric Posner, Glenn Weil proposal to allow people to value their own homes and pay property taxes based on that, but then have anyone come and be able to buy it. They call it like a self-assessed tax. So like these are not immediately implementable ideas, but whether those are worth exploring as ways to solve some of the problems of transaction costs and incentives to develop.
So for a long time, the number one pro-homeownership program in the United States was the mortgage interest deduction. It's been cut basically in half by the TCJA. The mortgage interest deduction was not a conscious strategy to subsidize homeownership. When the federal income tax was implemented in 1913, we allowed all types of deductions for interest. And over time, that meant things like credit card interest and other types of consumer interest, and we started paring that back. And then all of a sudden, all we have is deductions for mortgage interest, and then we start calling it a homeownership subsidy. It doesn't make any sense from the get-go, right? So you would never, the mortgage interest deduction subsidizes mortgage debt. It doesn't subsidize homeownership. It subsidizes mortgage debt, and it subsidizes whatever rate your marginal tax rate is in. So if you have a dollar of mortgage debt, you get 37 cents back if you're in the top income bracket, and then it gradually goes down. That's insane. You would never start, if we started from scratch and someone said, let's develop a tax policy to subsidize homeownership, and someone raised their hand and said, let's subsidize debt instead of homeownership, and let's give higher income people a higher rate of subsidy, let's do that, they'd get kicked out of the room. So we had this really sort of bizarre subsidy for home ownership that wasn't very effective. And if you look at study after study, we found that the mortgage interest deduction just increases more debt and increases more expensive homes. It doesn't increase the rate of home ownership. So what can we do? So I had a paper about this maybe 4 or 5 years ago. We looked at the economic consequences of a few different strategies. One strategy we thought was have a first-time home buyer tax credit. Get people in the home in the first place. Homes aren't just places where you live. They're vehicles for accumulating assets. How about we just get people started early as sort of a pro-saving measure? So we sort of looked at about a $10,000 first-time home buyer's tax credit as an option. Another thing we looked at is saying, look, let's just give us a tax credit every year. So now people get $2,000 every year for having a child. We don't just give when the child is born, here's $10,000. We say, look, we give you $2,000 every year. Why not have an annual homeownership tax credit? We say as long as you're a home buyer, we see value in that. Have about $2,000 a year if you're a married couple and $1,500 if you're single. And another thing we looked at was sort of a rebate on property taxes. But the point is that there are lots of ways to improve on the mortgage interest deduction. It's not effective at increasing homeownership. It's unequal. And now it's only available to a few people.
You had a question right there. You will get the last one.
Rick Rybeck with Just Economics. You were talking about the value in home ownership, and I just can't let that go unaddressed. As somebody who used to be a renter, I'm a homeowner now, but I think one of the reasons why people think that homeowners are better people, more involved in the community, this, that, and the other thing, gets back to something that was said before. In many places in the country, the landlord, on a whim, can either kick you out or double your rent. So if you don't have security of tenure, are you going to get involved in the school? Are you going to get involved in the community? It's a security of tenure issue. And one of the main motivations for home ownership at the turn of the last century was to get security of tenure so you wouldn't get kicked out. And then because of all the what's happened with mortgage interest and other types of deductions. It's morphed into a wealth-building scheme. The other thing that I think is important to recognize is that when we talk about housing affordability and what to do, and some people say, well, the best thing to do is, you know, a wage program, get people's incomes up. You know, people have said this in our discussion. You go out to Akron, Toledo, Gary, Indiana, home prices are really cheap there. But the factories have closed down. If I don't have a job, even a cheap home is unaffordable. And you go to Silicon Valley and people are making six-figure incomes and they can't afford a home. And it's not the price of lumber or pipes that's more expensive in these places. It's the price of land. And that's because we have this upside-down tax system that you've referred to and you've referred to, which is that if you we say we want more affordable housing, more jobs, but if somebody has the audacity to put up a building or improve a building, we raise their tax, not just the year they make that improvement, but every year thereafter. The net present value of the typical property tax is like a 10 to 20% sales tax on labor and construction costs. That's crazy. On the other hand, if you hold a piece of land vacant and let the government improve public services around you, you make money in your sleep. So we encourage that by taxing land low. So we've got this upside-down system. Some places in Pennsylvania have reduced the tax, property tax rate applied to buildings, increased it on land. Without losing any money or spending more money, these people have lowered the cost of buildings and the price of land. So that's something that I'm surprised nobody talks about. People seem not to know about it. But it's been very effective. It's fundamental economics, and yet never gets addressed. And I would hope that maybe Brookings and other people could deal with it. I appreciate the gentleman for asking the question.
We are running out of time. Yeah, very quickly, the last question.
I'll be very quick, and I didn't want to do that because I asked the question to the wrong panel, but some of my colleagues raised the issue again. How about taxing, increasing the property tax in order to achieve a lot of things, like densifying, you know, house affordability, urban mobility, commuting, building schools, etc., and also taxing the land more heavily. And actually, the land could be taxed progressively. So you, a certain rate for a quarter of acre, another rate for second, for half an acre, depending on the local community.
And I thought that that was the spirit of your the next iteration, where you have a basically a property tax that applies to a certain higher end group of homes, and then it gets used for affordable housing or for other services.
Right. Well, there are some discussions you know, along those lines, and of course we're only bounded by our a creativity, and some people, you know, could be very creative in coming up with new tax schemes, especially, of course, when if we talk about land internationally, it's very concentrated. Let's say 1% of less than 1% of people in England own you know, most of the land, right? So, the report just came out on that, and we have a similar situation here in the United States as well. So, of course, it's a very interesting idea. I would not be dismissive, but it needs more careful thinking, and it requires, I think, a wider debate.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming, and thanks to our panelists for appearing. Appreciate it.